And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A recent open letter to be published in Harper's Magazine, October issue, which was also published online, was signed by over 130 notable figures from academia and popular media, and it's reignited debate about the nature of free speech. So discussions of so-called cancel culture also continue to percolate as widespread protest movements around the country flood into online and public discourse about what is or is not appropriate to say or to publish, the consequences that one should or should not face for their speech, and to whom we all should be accountable. So let's talk about cancel culture. Joining Cincinnati Edition to discuss our Vox culture staff writer, Asia Romano. They join us via Skype. Asia, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We also have Associate Professor of Communication and Political Communication at Xavier University, Dr. Leslie Rasmussen. Dr. Rasmussen, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And Journalism Department Head and Associate Professor at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Jeffrey Blevins. Dr. Blevins, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be back on the show.
Awesome. And you're also on, you're on the phone now. It was going to be Skype. We're supposed to say when you're on Skype and you are on the phone. Perfect. But we do have a phone line open. If you're listening and want to weigh in on cancel culture and what you think about it, it's 513-419-7100. Also want to note that we'll be discussing Asia's new article just out today. You've probably heard the name Karen floated around recently as descriptor of a particular type of individual that you've seen on social media. The article is titled How Karen Became a Watchword for Racism. We'll be discussing that a little bit later in the show. But first, I should set this up by referencing that Harper's letter again by reading a little piece of this. It reads, quote, "The free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. While we have come to expect this on the radical right, censoriousness is also spreading more widely in our culture, an intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues in a blinding moral certainty." That's just a little piece of this letter, but I want to note that since it's in the context of cancel culture that we have this conversation today, that letter was met by, quote, a more specific letter on justice and open debate. It was also signed by a lot of journalists. And this article described the signers of the previous one as the signatories, many of them white, wealthy, and endowed with massive platforms, argue that they are afraid of being silenced, that so-called cancel culture is out of control, and that they fear for their jobs and free exchange of ideas, even as they speak from one of the most prestigious magazines in the country. Asia, let me start with you. What's going on in discourse right now? I mean, is it safe to have a conversation? Is it safe to have a take at all? Or should we just expect, since we're all connected, we all have megaphones now, that sure, there's going to be pushback, there's going to be criticism, and we just have to learn how to deal with it?
Well, I think you have to put all of this in the context of the internet and the rise of social media, and especially the way that social media allows more people who had previously historically been marginalized from public conversation to have voices and to participate in that conversation. Make sense? So now you have more people giving a plethora of viewpoints and more perspectives on issues of the day. And I think people who had previously felt like they sort of had a proprietary right to those conversations are feeling threatened and pushed to the side by newer and not newer, but more visible viewpoints. And so that creates this this atmosphere where people who maybe aren't being pushed to the side as much as they think they are feel like they're being threatened, and they feel like their power is diminishing. And so that creates this friction between people who are just now feeling empowered and like they have the right using social media to speak out and say how they feel, and people who are like, what are you doing? This isn't, like, we're not comfortable.
But it seems to go beyond expressing discomfort in someone's take. I think what we're saying about cancel culture, as loosely defined by me or, you know, other people who have written about this or spoken about it, is, okay, this person said something that was characterized as offensive or was offensive. How far does the society go in reprimanding that person? Are we lacking a set of consistent standards as it relates to people when they are targeted for, quote, canceling?
Well, you have to. So the word canceling, as it was originally used, came about in Black social media around 2015. And it sort of started out as a joke. But then as it spread and became more of a culturally known idea, people in the Black community began using it as almost like the way that civil rights boycotts in the 60s functioned, as a way to say, hey, I may not have much like larger systemic power, but I do have personal power. And so my power is to cancel you. And it's sort of an individual one-on-one thing. Like it's essentially like a social boycott. But what happened is that as that grew into a larger, more well-known idea, people who were on the other side of being quote-unquote canceled began to react to it as though it was something of a mob mentality, as though like the collective decision to cancel someone had real power that I'm not sure we've ever proven that it does have. And I think you can even look at like the most recent person to be canceled, J.K. Rowling, as you said, even though her transphobia has been widely distributed and discussed in the media, she still has, as of today, like 14 million followers on Twitter. And her publisher just put out a release this morning saying that sales of the Harry Potter books had actually pushed their children's publishing division revenue over a quarter over the last 6 months, like during the pandemic. Like, so transphobia in her case actually increased her profitability. So I'm not sure that we really have met any sort of like, I guess, systematized criteria that we can say is actually an impact of canceling, other than people as individuals, once again, saying, I'm just going to ignore you. So I think a lot of the conversation around canceling misses the reality that personal canceling doesn't really do much to actually cancel a person's career.
And we're talking with Asia Romano, a culture staff writer at Vox. We're also joined by two local university professors. We have Associate Professor of Communication and Political Communication at Xavier, Dr. Leslie Rasmussen. And we also have the head of the Journalism Department at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Jeffrey Blevins. Let me ask you, Leslie, in this age of social media and some of the dangers that people's pose when they're unearthed, so to speak, if they're young and in college like your students are, and they act up on social and 10 years down the road, they're running for office or they're running a business, that could come back to haunt them. How do you approach this on the educational side?
Well, on the educational side, I teach about personal branding in two of my courses. And part of that is really trying to get students to understand that anything they put online should really be part an extension of their professional presence online. So scrub your social media. Remember, what you thought at 16 may not be what you think at 26. And, you know, we have seen where those old, posts are unearthed and people lose scholarships. They are penalized at their job or they lose a job and that sort of thing. So from my perspective in the classroom is just really trying to get them to focus on this is not a black hole that you can throw whatever you want into. There will be consequences. And I personally don't believe that it's stifling freedom of speech. As some have argued, most recently, Ted Cruz argued that people were stifling the Goya CEO's First Amendment right by threatening to, boycott, if you will. I think it was boycott or cancel. In that example, it's a free marketplace, right? People have the choice to decide where to spend their money. And we are in a place where people want to align or spend money and consume with folks that align with their values more and more. That's a pretty common assumption in public relations and advertising right now. I know I'm veering off from the education side, but that's kind of where I end up taking it in the class.
And you referenced Goya. That's the food brand whose CEO recently celebrated President Donald Trump and faced some serious backlash from folks, prompting both the president and his daughter Ivanka to pose on social media posts and images promoting the brand Goya, while there were people calling for boycotts of that brand. Let me ask you a similar question, Jeffrey. You teach journalism. In what context is this theme explored today in journalism classrooms like yours?
Yeah, well, it's sadly, a great case study in how speech and power are intertwined. And, you know, the answers aren't always so clear. We have to do some unpacking, you know. And some of the questions that, you know, we would ask is, you know, is canceling always in proportion with the attraction? By canceling someone, are we also inhibiting that person's ability to learn, to grow from their mistakes? So here we're not really talking about the powerful or celebrities being canceled, but what happens when someone makes, you know, a somewhat, you know, innocuous mistake? But that leads me to another question, then, you know, is canceling necessarily social justice or is it social punishment? And I think this is where we really have to do the unpacking. It's a matter of where, you know, power resides and how it operates in these situations. You know, it can be a situation where the powerless are pushing back against the powerful, or it can be, in some cases, a greater extension of power by the powerful. So consider, you know, a couple of local cases. In 2018, Terry's Turf Club. Here we had a food server who was recorded a Facebook video of the owner making derogatory and sexually explicit remarks about her after he'd fired her. And what power did this young woman have? Really none. But being able to express the owner's behavior on social media was one way for her to push back at the unfairness of her situation. The injustice was exposed. The restaurant suffered negative reviews, and as a result, the owner ended up selling the business. But it really didn't do anything for the aggrieved woman. This case was in the original spirit of canceling, as developed on Black Twitter, as AJ had said earlier. It acknowledged the structural inequality it confronted by wielding another form of power. I may not get back what I deserve. I may not get back, you know, my job. But you, the owner, the powerful, are going to lose something to it. It's kind of like a powerlessness corrective. But let's look at another case, 2019, where you had a Cincinnati council member, Chris Seelbach, who used his platform to draw attention to a tri-health nurse who had made homophobic and transphobic remarks on her personal Facebook account. Seelbach already had status and power by virtue of his city council office. Moreover, he was just asking for the nurse to be, he wasn't just asking for the nurse to be personally held accountable for her remarks. He was suggesting with the hashtag boycott TriHealth that, you know, accountability really rested in TriHealth. And this is where kind of the piling on comes in. It's not just the threat of losing Seelbach's business, TriHealth losing Seelbach's business, that is the threat. It's all the social media reaction that tends to follow. Is TriHealth homophobic or transphobic because one employee on her personal Facebook page, you know, are they, is the whole, you know, organization accountable for that? Well, you know, of course not. But not everyone who likes and retweets that hashtag is necessarily going to contextualize that issue. Now, was Seelbach rightfully aggrieved by the nurse who made this post? Yes, absolutely. But did it necessarily merit a boycott of TriHealth by a Cincinnati council member who already has position and platform? You know, I'm not so sure.
Let me bring back Asia Romano, the culture staff writer at Vox. So you've heard some local examples from here in the Cincinnati area from Dr. Blevins there. And I would wonder, since you're tuned into this type of activity online and have written so much about it, do you find that people are more willing to forgive those who align with them politically and more eager to go after those who don't? It, because there does appear to be a little bit of an inconsistency in the application of standards for who should be, quote, canceled or should face some online outrage?
This is a really complex question, and I think a lot of it depends on how the, quote, unquote, canceled react, right? So you can have people who listen to the critics and who try to make amends, who try to atone, and who do apologize sincerely, right? Or you can have people like Louis C.K., who do all of those things and then 18 months later show up doing a comedy sketch where they basically are aligning themselves with reactionary politics and basically going after everything that they previously said that they were trying to align themselves with, right? So there's a question of sincerity. There's a question of actions taken after the fact to basically make good on your attempt to apologize. I think that many people are right to be wary of performative stances, especially in an age where everything is so polarized and it's so easy to just to, I think, to say and do things on social media that you don't actually mean in real life. And also it's so easy to just align yourselves with all of the people who are, well, I sort of think of it as bad actors, people who basically hated you before you suddenly became unpopular with the libs, if that makes sense.
Sure.
It's really easy to just turn to that welcoming embrace of all those people who previously hated you, who now think that you're cool because you're being hated on by the internet. And I think that's dangerous. I think that those, there are personal considerations there. Everybody is going to react differently. And I think that there's a real misunderstanding that gets sort of amplified in these situations about, you know, what someone's personal context may have been that day they said the thing that they said. And the person who's being canceled often doesn't look beyond their personal hurt and their personal sense of being wounded to try and place their actions within, say, a larger context. You know, why does it matter that J.K. Rowling is being transphobic right now? She said that she is a domestic violence victim. She has had all sorts of very, very humanizing personal experiences that make her, that she feels make her viewpoint valid, right? But she, from her perspective, maybe can't hear her critics who are saying, place this in the context of every other transphobic action that's been done to harm trans people since the beginning of humanity, right? Like, and see how your actions are contributing to, like, hurt on a much larger scale. I think people often can't place their actions within that larger scale. But the people who are trying to cancel them, the people who are mad at them, all they're seeing is the larger scale. And I think sometimes those things are really hard to reconcile. And it's not always easy to talk about, especially when we have to place it. I think people who are mad about cancel culture want to frame everything through the lens of punishment and absolution. And I think a lot of times things just take time. It takes empathy and a willingness to understand tolerance and to listen to people who you may not initially agree with. And of course, I think that all gets increasingly polarized when you have the discussion of like human rights and the fact that so much of today's debate seems to come down to the ultimate like baseline question of, are people people? And it seems like we're just increasingly not sure. So that's a whole other complex layer of this that I don't think really gets upfronted enough.
And we got an email from listener Tim who writes, cancel culture is an extension of part of the Me Too movement. There have been real life consequences as a result. To name a few, Tim writes, Jim Mathis of Hardball and ex-Senator Alan Stewart Franken, both victims of the movement. Was it just? He says, I think that it depends on who you ask. We also got an email from Neil, who writes an email that I will summarize and says that he knows of a local individual who was canceled. We won't identify him, but a skater who moved to L.A. And then a four-year-old Snapchat image reemerged and was published by an old high school classmate. Quote, the result was the collapse of his pro skateboarding career literally within 24 hours. The notion that this doesn't affect people is insane and disingenuous at best. I'm exceedingly liberal, but the range of outrage is broad. And you can email us at talk@wvxu.org or call us at 513-419-7100. We're going to continue this conversation after this short break. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks, and we continue now with our discussion on cancel culture. We're joined on Skype by Vox Culture staff writer Asia Romano. Asia, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure.
And we're also joined on the phone by two local professors that we like having on, Associate Professor of Communication and Political Communication at Xavier, Dr. Leslie Rasmussen. Leslie, welcome back. And we had the Journalism Department head and professor at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Jeffrey Blevins. Jeffrey, thank you for being with us also.
Always good to be here, Michael.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation, or email talk@wvxu.org. Leslie, I want to follow up with you on the email we just received from our listener, Neil, who talked about a friend who had a skateboarding career that was brought down within 24 hours because of a Snapchat image that was, as he said, 4 years old. I don't know all the details of this outside of what he emailed, but this goes to what you were saying about scrubbing your social media. How do you do that? How do you have that mindset to even know what you snapped when you were 16 years old by the time you're in graduate school studying personal branding?
That's a great point. But I mean, so people like myself or Jeff, you know, we were older when social media really picked up steam. So it's not like we were doing those things. At least, you know, I don't want to speak for Jeff, but I'm sure that he wasn't. These kids that we see now, though, have had it since they were 10, 11, 12, you know, and it's just this idea of, well, you really have to connect with them and make sure they understand that. Go back and explore what you did when you were 14, 15, 16. It's terrible because we should allow people the grace to grow and learn, right? And yet at the same time, because we know there are consequences, much like Neil mentioned, we have to sort of get these students to understand they need to be proactive about it because they are working hard, they are growing, they are learning and expanding their worldviews. And what they posted at 15, you know, it's unfortunate, but I would hate to see that come back and, you know, bite them at 20. One thing that I wanted to mention also is I think it's important that we distinguish between public criticism and cancel culture versus call out culture, and then also the free marketplace versus cancel culture. You know, I think a lot of those things have gotten blurred together. You know, and sort of created this masterful cancel culture that we talk about in negative terms. But I mean, there is a distinction between all of those things, I believe.
I think that's a good point that you raise, Leslie, and let me bring in Dr. Blevins to add to that, if possible. Is it possible that if the term cancel culture, for example, just automatically derive some negative connotation that will automatically dismiss the type of criticism that goes towards someone?
Right. And I think Leslie raises a really good point. It led me to think about some, you know, important legal distinctions as well about where, you know, speech occurs, right? Whether it's a public venue or a private venue. So public spaces like universities, where Leslie and I work at, and especially universities, should be places that probe and debate ideas and ideals. And, you know, things might be offensive sometimes. So I'm loath to support canceling someone's expression, you know, in these venues. You know, a call out is very different, but you know, any public venue for that matter. But I'm also, you know, a person that honestly, I think, tends to take a rather conservative view of the First Amendment, in that I see it there as to protect us against government restriction of our rights of expression, right? Now, that leads to the other point then. Well, how does canceling play out in private venues? Well, that's altogether a different matter. I mean, you really don't have free speech on private property. At the same time, there seems to be some imbalance, and I think this is kind of all the problems that are being pointed out here, particularly with the skater, in canceling someone's job, canceling someone's livelihood, for something that they said or did in a public space, right? It's legally, it's not a problem, but it's causing you this other issue. And it's problematic because these digital spaces, like social media, are really blurring what used to be more easily defined geographically as public or private. And now that said, you know, corporations have speech rights too. Your employers have speech rights too. My personal feeling is that corporate speech rights is rank legal fiction, but the Supreme Court of the United States disagrees, and so its interpretation prevails. You know, an entity with First Amendment rights in the United States, therefore, has a right to disassociate with expression it disagrees with, you know, without necessarily having to go through the context of, oh, this person was young, and, you know, do we grant them grace? Do we give them, you know, a chance to grow? This is, you know, precisely why, you know, NASCAR has a right to ban Confederate flags at its races.
513-419-7100 is the number. Let's take a phone call. We've got Alyssa on the line. Hi, Alyssa. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I think it was addressed. Leslie mentioned it in the free market culture, and I think perhaps that's my comment. I'm familiar with the term girl-codding, and that is using my money to support organizations and companies that align with my value system. And for me, as I feel like that's where my power lies, I vote religiously, and I've always voted, and I will continue to vote. But right now, it seems like corporations have so much control of my government. The only way to really make the world a better place is to no longer support financially companies that I look at as being corrupt and continuing systemic isms, whether that's racism or sexism or any of the isms. So, and I was really concerned. I noticed this can be a slippery slope when the Dixie Chicks came out against the war. And for the first time, it made me wonder about this because they weren't being boycotted for what they did, for actions, which typically is what happens. They were being boycotted for their beliefs. So that's where, for me, it gets a little dicey. But thank you for the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for taking the time to give us a call and join the conversation. We should note, not that I'm a country music aficionado. Okay, I am, but they're just the Chicks now, right? They're just the Chicks. So, and they've got a great new album out. Let's take a call from Chan. Hi, Chan. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. Good afternoon. I was calling about this really interesting discussion and how someone had brought up about how cancel culture is treated like this monolithic entity. And I was just curious about, you know, the panelists' response to the idea of separating the artist from their body of work. And I think one of their examples was perfect, like J.K. Rowling, where we have this artist, this creator, who created a world that was supposed to be specifically inclusive, and yet now they are speaking in terms that are very exclusive. And it's very, very painful, I think, for fans. But then you also have someone like Picasso, for example, who made mistakes of their time, but it's also now very difficult to look at his work without thinking about the sorts of things that occurred during his lifetime. So I was just sort of wondering what the panelists thought about that and separating the artists from their body of work and how, as we go through the cycle of, as they say, punishment and absolution, how we accept their apologies and taking in that context.
Chan, great point. Thank you so much for listening and calling and sharing your views with us. Asia, let's have you handle that if you don't mind.
Sure. I actually wrote an entire article about this, specifically in response to J.K. Rowling, but also this is something as a culture critic that I've thought about a lot, of course. I believe in some cases that's harder than it is in others. You know, it really depends on your personal relationship to the art. You know, for example, I was a huge Kevin Spacey fan for many, many years and, you know, just had to completely sever all emotional ties with that part of my, you know, my love for his films and everything, you know, for instantly that was over, you know, just no more going forward there. There's nothing you can do to excuse that kind of sexual predation, right? Like he's a monster and we should say so. So there are some moments I think where it's easier than others. Figuring out how to deal with J.K. Rowling is a lot harder, I think, for many, many people because Harry Potter itself is so much a huge part of people's lives on a very collective, massive scale. For me personally, I came to the conclusion that the best way to approach it was to essentially consider it a breakup with J.K. Rowling, where she got to keep the parts of Harry Potter that she likes, and I get custody of all the stuff that she doesn't. You know, so I get custody of the Harry Potter that I and so many other fans collectively created, and we get to move forward with that. I think in academic context, and of course the actual academics here can speak more closely to this, but I think it's a lot easier to place many of these things in context when you're teaching a work of art like Picasso and you want to talk about all the, you know, his sexism and misogyny, or someone like Ezra Pound, who had a huge influence over 20th century art and modernism and poetry, but was also a raging white supremacist. It's a lot easier to sort of really upfront those things. But I think when it's culture that's happening now, and it's not something that's squarely behind us, when it's not like an H.P. Lovecraft who's very dead, you know, it's a lot harder to sort of navigate things like Rowling and Woody Allen and Polanski and so forth. But I think we're having those discussions, and that's what's important.
And I don't mean to turn the end of the show into one about country music, but I mean, that's kind of how we've had to deal with Hank Williams Jr. as well, with his racist comments during the President Obama administration. But All My Rowdy Friends still slaps, right? Okay, so I know, Asia, you've got this new article out today, so it's good timing that you came on. I've only got a minute left, but it's about Karen, the name. Just instead of going too in-depth with it, as I'd hoped to do, just give us a brief overview of what readers will find, and we'll make sure we link to it at WVXU.org if people can't find it elsewhere.
Sure. It's basically a map, a roadmap of how Karen went from being a sort of loving but jocular, like basically amused, poking fun at suburban moms, to this very scathing attack on white supremacy in the form of white privileged womanhood.
And that's a pretty good synopsis. So let me thank all of you for being on here. Asia Romano, a culture staff writer at Vox, and our local professors, Leslie Rasmussen from Xavier University and Jeffrey Blevins from the University of Cincinnati. It's always such a pleasure to have you on. Asia, we hope we can have you on again sometime too.
Of course.
And again, just a quick reminder that Governor Mike DeWine's previously scheduled press conference about the COVID-19 pandemic that was scheduled for today at 2 o'clock has been postponed until tomorrow. At 2 o'clock, he has decided to postpone it because of a 2:30 p.m. scheduled news conference involving the U.S. Attorney's Office after the arrest this morning of Republican Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder. We will have that developing story covered for you on air here on 91.7, as well as online at WVXU.org. WOSU, our friends at that station, will be live streaming the U.S. Attorney's press conference. So if you are interested in what the Attorney's Office has to say, you can look them up and listen to it there. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. You can find archives of our program online every day at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.